Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Tonight on CNS News, a Central Valley mailman guides us through a foreclosed neighborhood. Oakland street vendors fight to keep their food clean, and Svetovora reviews this year's best picture. First, we head to the South Bay, where there's a controversy around tasers.
They've been marketed as a safe alternative to guns, but they've resulted in the deaths of 355 people.
Until her father's death, Noreen Salinas was studying law enforcement, hoping to join the San Jose Police Department. Now, she's taking the cops to court.
I heard there's a lot of evidence, heavy evidence, so it's looking good. So, you know, baby steps and, you know, we'll get them.
Salinas' father is one of six people killed by taser use since the San Jose Police Department began using them in 2004.
He was a Marine. He worked full-time. He was a truck driver for years and years. And he was a good man.
According to police and coroner reports, in May of 2007, nine officers responding to a complaint burst into Steve Salinas' room at the Vagabond Inn. As he emerged from the shower, naked, the officers tased him, tied him up, and beat him. He died on the scene from cardiac arrest.
Why did they do that? And how many other people have they been doing this to?
The district attorney's office has been asking the same questions. They are currently investigating last month's death of 26-year-old Richard Lua. A recent study by UCSF doctors shows that tasers aren't quite the preventative tool they were meant to be.
In the first full year of taser deployment, when you looked at all the police departments that we surveyed, that there was a six-fold increase in custody deaths.
Although he declined to be interviewed, Assistant Chief Daniel Katz told us, tasers have reduced injuries to subjects and to the officers involved. The San Jose Police Department feels that this piece of equipment is of value to our officers. However, more and more citizens are becoming concerned. The Raging Grannies, a local activist group, recently formed a Taser Watch Committee.
We say you. Lower crime in neighborhoods, zapping people with a current only kills and does no good.
The tone of their protest may be light, but the women are serious about their message.
A policeman may hesitate to use a gun, but in many cases they won't hesitate to use a taser.
People and families like us keep getting hurt, and we're losing loved ones over this.
After 2 years of delays, Salinas will finally get her day in court this March.
The lawsuit is for, we're going against City of San Jose, Taser International, we're holding them liable. I just want justice for my dad.
This is Nigeri Eaton for CNS News.
Stockton has made headlines as the foreclosure capital of the nation. Today we take another look at this Central Valley town, this time through the eyes of one mail carrier.
At the Hammer Ranch Post Office in Stockton, California, each day begins the same for John Montez. He drinks his coffee, checks the schedule, then begins casing his route. He's been carrying mail in this city for 23 years.
Love my job, really do.
Since the recession hit, the volume of mail the U.S. Postal Service receives has dropped dramatically, down nearly 10 billion pieces over last fiscal year.
There was times when we would have this much mail in each of these little slots. This is all we have now.
But one type of mail, the undeliverable, is actually on the rise, a direct result of the staggering number of Stockton residents who have lost their homes to foreclosure.
But when they do leave, when they are foreclosed on, most of the people do not put a change of address in. They don't want any creditors following them. You know, and I can't blame them.
Stockton is among the area's hardest hit by the nationwide housing meltdown. Last year, it replaced Detroit atop a list of America's most miserable cities. Here, one in every 27 homes faces foreclosure.
This house here on the corner with the real estate sign is a foreclosure.
A rash of irresponsible home loans and plummeting property values helped fuel the collapse.
The value of the property is half of what it was worth before. People aren't going to stay with those houses. They can't. Your whole psyche as a nation is down the toilet.
Montez has delivered foreclosure notices to more than 60 homes on his route in the past year.
There's more coming every day. 2 days ago, I had six that I had to notify. Today, so far, in the mail, just one.
and he's often the first to know. A bank address sent certified mail, so the lender knows the owner received it. Today's notice is addressed to a pair of immigrant families who bought this home on a quiet, middle-class street 3 years ago.
It's one of the worst feelings, not being able to tell them. I sympathize with them, but not being able to verbalize, hey, you know, I'm sorry I'm delivering this.
Montez has been in their shoes. He owned a home in this same neighborhood, but faced with family health problems, lost salary, and a ballooning mortgage, he was forced to sell at a huge loss.
I'm not numb to it because I've lived it.
He barely escaped foreclosure and moved his family to a rental apartment across town.
Hey, here, let me give you your mail, Jan.
But he's still delivering the mail, with more bad news arriving in envelopes every day. This is Matt Durning for CNS News.
West Berkeley residents are organizing against a local steel company, who they say is releasing air pollution into their community.
Berkeley parents and their children often visit the city's playgrounds for some exercise and fresh air. But recent news have West Berkeley residents questioning what exactly is in their air.
Air quality in Berkeley is likely to remain a controversial issue for many of us.
A national study from USA Today recently placed West Berkeley schools in the top 2 percentiles for toxic air pollution.
I was surprised to learn that I lived in a steel town and had lots of questions about air quality in Berkeley and the role of Pacific Steel.
Pacific Steel Casting Company is the largest source of pollution in Berkeley. It's been operating in West Berkeley for 75 years. The plant makes steel parts for use in machinery, construction, and other industries.
Pacific Steel and Casting came up very high, and one of the reasons is that in 2005, Pacific Steel and Casting emitted quite a bit of manganese.
In the same year, the plant also released a host of chemicals like nickel, naphthalene, and chromium, all at tolerable levels, according to local air quality officials.
There is 20 years worth of information about this issue. It's very all over the place, and there are lawsuits here and engineering firms there.
Erica Kemp's children attend two of the three schools ranked in the first and second percentile for toxic air pollution.
The real question is not how much manganese is it okay for my kid to take into their body, but whether it's okay at all for them to take manganese into their body.
That question has been answered by the Environmental Protection Agency, and they have designated a level. Pacific Steel Casting is under that level.
But that is not enough for parents whose children breathe the air in West Berkeley on a daily basis.
I think we need to have a defensible set of data from, you know, a credible firm, and I think we should employ them so that they work for us and only us.
Concerned parents are deciding if they should test the air themselves, but they may get some help first. They're petitioning the Environmental Protection Agency to get federal monitors to do more comprehensive testing. So for now, everything's up in the air. All they can do is hold their breath and wait. This is Christine Wong for CNS News.
Imagine a place where you can walk in, pick out anything you want, and take it away for free. It's called a library. And as times get tough, business here is booming.
One spot in town can be certain it won't lose any customers during the recession.
Man, everybody loves the word free, and this is genuinely free, and how can you beat it?
Berkeley public libraries were already vibrant, with residents checking out over 3 times the state average. And this year, they've seen a 14% spike in visits.
It's not a surprise that this is happening, and it's a pattern that's been noticed nationwide.
And patrons aren't coming to the library only for the books.
I primarily use it for web access. My computer at home is down, but I'm also looking for a job. I'm not in a position to, like, buy a new system or to take care of those computer problems.
Well, we are the de facto internet service provider for a large segment of the population.
Many patrons are also skipping movie rentals in favor of the library's DVDs, for which demand has sharply risen. But the pressure on all library services is also putting a strain on personnel.
It's always a challenge to keep a library adequately staffed.
One would hope that in these hard times that they'll be mindful of that and not say, well, we have to cut services too. So I hope that they'll keep the library open more.
For now, Berkeley libraries continue to grow thanks to the voters who passed a $26 million bond to expand the 4 neighborhood branches. This is Gail Four for CNS News.
Newspapers across the country are knocking on death's door. I spoke to one local editor who's not going to give up without a fight.
Save the planet. The slogan took on new meaning last month when Berkeley's 10-year-old local paper headlined its own front page.
Who ever thought there was big money in small local newspapers? I don't know.
Editor Becky O'Malley and her husband Michael bought the Daily Planet 6 years ago. They have covered expenses out of their own pockets, but now they're looking for nonprofit certification and help from the community. The first three pages of the February 19th issue were devoted to the paper's economic plight, exalting the virtues of local news and encouraging readers to contribute something to keep the free paper alive.
The question is the content valuable enough? Is there enough of an audience willing to pay voluntarily for content in a place like Berkeley?
With that question pending, the Daily Planet joined the ranks of newspapers crumbling across the country.
We can't really reverse the trend in the industry, I think, much as we might like to. You can see we have a luxurious office here with fancy amenities. We won't be able to cut down on our expenses.
The reason for the downturn seems clear. The internet made it cheaper for businesses to advertise and for readers to get their news.
The media companies, rather foolishly, committed the original sin of enabling all their content to be given away for free. Either people will learn to pay for content or the content won't be there.
While the Daily Planet has received some assistance, O'Malley doesn't know if the donations will keep coming. Still, she says she's hopeful.
I think that the people really do want the product, and that's good. We really get a lot of enthusiasm from our readers.
But enthusiasm doesn't pay the bills, and without a little extra help, Berkeley's decade-long experiment with its own free paper may soon be over. This is Maggie Fosley-Farad for CNS News.
How do you think it would feel to take a giant swig of wine and feel it burn your mouth? Winemakers are working to make sure that doesn't happen.
In the heart of California wine country, dozens of winemakers have discovered that something's gone wrong.
Absolutely not acceptable. Nobody would want to drink that.
John Ketchmer is an oenologist at Vinquery, a wine lab in Sonoma County. Winemakers come to them when they want chemicals in their wine tested or altered. A few months ago, the lab started fielding requests from winemakers who needed to remove a particularly offensive flavor, smoke. They blame the 2008 California wildfires.
One day there was nothing there. 2 or 3 days later, they had hundreds of fires in Mendocino County.
More than 2,000 fires broke out over the summer, and Mendocino County, home to 73 wineries, was hit hard. Some wine grapes absorbed the smoke into their skins, giving the wines a disturbing taste.
Words that are usually used are smoky, ashtray, barbecue, cured meats. If your descriptors are usually cherries and violets and so on, throwing in those descriptors are probably not what your consumer wants.
That's why the lab is developing ways to remove smoke flavor from the wine using different neutralizers that range from egg whites to chemicals. We tried an unfiltered wine from Mendocino County that had been affected by the fires.
Oh, that's delicious.
And it burns.
Yeah, and it just kind of persists there.
It's just like, you know, drinking a cigarette.
The economic impact on the state's $52 billion a year wine industry is unknown. The Australians suffered the same problem in 2006, costing them 35,000 tons of grapes and $100 million in exports. Consumers, however, are unlikely to notice any changes.
I'd be very surprised if any winemaker worth their salt would ever release wines like this.
Climate change experts fear that fires like those in 2008 could become more common. But even if nature has its way, at least there may be a man-made solution. This is Christina Salerno for CNS News.
Vendors selling tamales and fruit fill East Oakland streets, but some longtime vendors are now angered that their new neighbors could be unlicensed and selling unclean food.
Victor Ramos is a bank teller who started selling tacos and soup on weekends last year. He says his family is one of many turning to street vending in these uncertain times.
With the food, people have to eat, so they come all the time. And we actually get a lot more customers now than we did before when we first started.
Though the city limits the number of vendors in Fruitvale to 30, some say there are now as many as 80 in the area. Manuel Beltran, a member of the East Oakland Food Vendor Association, ACAF, says it's because police no longer crack down on those without city permits and food safety certification.
Hay muchos vendedores que hacen lo mismo que nosotros.
con menos higiene que nosotros, ¿verdad? Y no pagan nada.
When the police stopped giving citation to those who were illegally selling out of the wood push cars and selling in the street with in tables and things like that, that's when the problem started growing and growing. Now it's out of hand.
Amelia Otero says each association member takes a state food handler's test, pays up to $1,200 for licenses and permits, and as much as $6,000 for a cart that's up to code. But they are in the minority. Otero says this year she helped to document more than 160 illegal vendors citywide, working with her daughter, Shelly Garza.
Selling, say, for instance, tamales with ice chests in the back of their trunks with gasoline or oil right next to the ice chest. They're selling tamales, pulling them out right there, and there's oil and there's gasoline right next to them.
A few weeks ago, the women took their case to City Hall.
Absolutely is a problem. I think she's right. Unfortunately, you know, our police department, which is the one that is responsible for policing the permits and enforcing them, are kind of busy doing some other things.
Otero and Garza understand the police are busy, battling a high crime rate and the aftermath of a shooting at the Fruitvale BART station. But the women warn continuing to leave vendors unregulated is taking a gamble with the public's health. This is Anna Bloom for CNS News.
The best-selling book, Three Cups of Tea, has inspired the Fremont community.
I'd like to introduce to you Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea.
Greg Mortensen is the author of best-selling book Three Cups of Tea, which chronicles his efforts of building schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He's bringing the gospel of how one person can make a difference to a local East Bay audience.
You have to touch poverty, you have to smell poverty, you have to be with poverty.
For most students, a country like Pakistan is far off. But One Book, One Community, a program sponsored by the American Association of University Women, has brought Three Cups of Tea into Fremont classrooms and encouraged teen discussions based on the book, like this one at Kennedy High School.
What is your personal opinion about the Muslim society?
The book resonates with students here because Fremont includes a large number of Afghani and Pakistani immigrants.
I know a couple of friends that they look like Muslims. You could tell straight up. If you're walking down the street, they're Muslims. And like people get scared of them because they think you're going to do something to them. But really, they're just nice, generous people that will like to help you.
One Book, One Community also promotes Mortensen's Pennies for Peace program, an initiative to empower students here to collect pennies to be put towards education in Pakistan.
Why is it important for them to have a school to go to?
Because they have goals to make, but they have to study first, and they have to have money to buy the supplies.
Young people are not so affected by area as they used to be, that nations aren't their total identity, but that they see themselves as part of humanity.
Many of the participants in One Book, One Community attended the Mortensen event.
Today, there are 7.2 million children in school in Afghanistan.
The greater thing is that it teaches children to be able to know that they can make a difference in the world.
I'm from Pakistan too, and I read this book. This is so great. You're a true hero. I'm one of your fans. You're awesome.
This is Sweta Vora for CNS News.
For one Berkeley man, his RV is more than just a recreational vehicle. It's the last thing standing between him and the streets.
I miss my mother's house, where I was raised up. I lived in that house for 56 years. Come on, sweetie.
After his mother died 2 years ago, Aleam Al-Ruloom's house went into foreclosure. He lost the property, but he wasn't quite ready to leave the neighborhood.
I really love this place.
So now he lives three blocks away in this 1978 Winnebago Itasca. It has a stove, a bathroom, and a television. But there's one little problem.
The way the laws are written, you're not supposed to live in a mobile home if you're inside the city limits. You just have to do the best you can. You have to move from place to place.
And he's not the only one on the move.
No, I know this guy here. Me and him is in basically the same situation.
Because they're always moving, it's next to impossible to count the number of RV dwellers in the city. But Berkeley officials estimate that several dozen people are violating city rules by living in mobile homes. Still, cracking down on them is a low priority. Aleam says police don't bother him unless
there could be somebody across the street that might complain.
Some neighbors, feel RVs on the streets decrease their property values, and they would like to see them gone.
I know eventually that I'm going to have to leave, but it's like first you have to pull your mind out of it. You got to go, you know. You have to take your mind away from it first, and then you can get your body away.
For now, income from recycling, coupled with food stamps, allows Aliam to support himself and maintain a home for him and his dog, Sweetie.
If I wasn't in this mobile home now, I would be on the street, in the rain. Instead, I'm living in an RV, so I'm blessed.
Aliam is giving himself one more year to say goodbye to Berkeley. In the meantime, he's saving up.
I'm expecting to get me another house, pay for it cash. Come on.
This is Shalice Haas for CNS News.
Come here. Hey.
Would you ever let two strangers crash on your couch? Recently, reporter Alba Mora welcomed two couch surfers into her Berkeley home.
Have you ever heard about couch surfing? I signed up last week. Soon I received an email. Can we sleep at your place? Sure. Here's my sofa. Waiting.
My name is Oliver Hora. I'm 36 years old and we come from Germany and...
Before you said my, this is my wife, Katie. Okay.
Katie and Ollie used to work as nurses in a small village in Germany. Now they are contemporary nomads surfing the worldwide couch.
A little like gypsies, maybe, you know? You just move from one place to another. Mm. Spontaneous, you know? Don't have a plan. Everything is have a plan when you used to live in a normal place. But this time we don't have a plan. We decided...
Our plan is we have no plan.
Following their route, I can see how the world is getting smaller. Qatar, Bangkok, Singapore, Hong Kong, Beijing, San Francisco. How do you pack a bag for so many places?
I have in my backpacks only useful things.
Passport, number one.
Some underwear.
Some credit cards, money, traveler's checks.
We share our soap.
Like t-shirts and a shorts.
A toothbrush.
A big hammock.
A towel.
My mosquito net. And have a first aid kit.
A little bit of mascara and lipstick.
When Ollie and Katie want to spend 2 weeks in Berkeley or any other place in the world, they log on to search for a couch instead of looking for a hotel room. And that's cool, because they buy me food and clean the apartment.
Everyone can rent an accommodation, a hotel.
Yeah.
But not everyone can sleep at a house, at a foreigner, on the couch.
This is Thailand song.
A song soon becomes a night full of shared experiences. On the 11th of August, they will have been traveling for 1 year. Are they ready to go home?
Ollie said, I want to go for 1 year. And I said, no, it's too much. And he said, believe me, 1 year, it's not too much. And then we decided to do it.
And now we feel that even 1 year is too less to travel.
I enjoy to be all the time together with Ollie.
Oh, that's very nice.
But it's true.
This is Alba Mora for CNS News.
Hip-hop and chess might sound like an odd combination, but it's teaching one group of San Francisco teens strategies for nonviolence.
In the library at John O'Connell High School, it's not uncommon to find Vibe magazine or books on graffiti resting on top of encyclopedias.
It's about things the kids care about. That's what they want.
What is unique is the addition of chess. In the last year, the game has grown in popularity at the school.
Me relajo. Prefiero juego que estar en la calle.
Adisa Banjoko started the Hip Hop Chess Federation. He is also a mentor at the school.
The chess board doesn't care whether you're black or white, whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't care what happened with you that day. The chess board always wants to see the best out of who you are.
Adisa comes in here as an African-American man, so a person of color. But he brings with him RZA or Rakim or San Quinn or Immortal Technique. And all of a sudden, we have all these role models, all these people of color coming to the school.
Banjoko says the relationship between chess and hip-hop began in the late 80s, when rappers began using chess metaphors to promote mental toughness in their communities. Banjoko believes chess can help young people develop patience and focus. 15-year-old Juan Molina agrees.
It's pretty much easy. It's like, once you start learning, like, what every piece does. But, like, the challenge is, like, trying to get, a strategy together to beat the other person.
Mate. It's also important that American youth understand the importance of thinking, of taking that extra second to make the right decision, not just in chess, but in other aspects of their own life.
Someone asked me, oh, you want to join a gang? That would be like a wrong step. But it's like, I'd be like, oh, no, I'm cool. You got to anticipate that so you don't fall into the trap.
I love to see them when they're really concentrating on the chessboard, like to watch their faces. I think they just look the best at those moments.
This is Amanda Martinez for CNS News.
And finally, film critic Sweta Vora offers her perspective on the blockbuster hit of the season.
In the past few months, a lot of people have come up to me and said, oh, you must have just loved Slumdog Millionaire. Is it because I'm brown? And just because I'm Indian, I should love it? No. Now let's get something straight. It's not a bad film. It's got some incredible rhythm, some great scenes, and some great actors. But it's the love story that I have a problem with. Now, a lot of people have been saying Danny Boyle is just paying homage to Bollywood, which is fine if it works. For years, Bollywood has offered these same tales of fate and star-crossed lovers, but there's a major difference. Bollywood films are these lavish Indian settings that rarely reflect everyday life. Boyle, on the other hand, brings to life this very authentic, gritty Mumbai, and then tries to immerse this fantasized love story. Do one or the other, but don't do both, because it doesn't work. Audiences here are taken by this feel-good movie because it's just an exotic fictional world. But for those of us who've experienced Mumbai, know that this exoticness is nothing but the everyday. And then a romantic fairy tale has no place in there. When the love story fails, it's hard to be in love with the movie. Now, again, it's not a bad film, and it's at times incredibly entertaining. But just to add in my last major irk, Dev Patel is not a Bollywood hero. Don't make him do Bollywood dancing. The final dance sequence in the movie doesn't make sense, it's not that good, so why is it that every late night show and talk show in America has to end with Patel and their entire crew dancing? Oh, Danny Boyle, look what you've begun.
That's it for CNS News. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.